some faces I know and a lot of people I've never met before. And as I was looking out on the people here, I was thinking about when I first came to practice and what vague ideas I had about what this practice is about. In a Zen tradition, we actually do a chant which says something like, the Dharma is vast and subtle, and we vow to understand it all. And it really is. It's quite amazing how, over the years, my experience has been that, boy, I really thought I understood it, you know? And then the understanding deepens, and it continues that way, really. It really is quite a... really deep practice that as we pursue it, the depth of understanding changes quite substantially. So how many people have experienced some form of suffering? So I don't have to go down to stress, discontent, dissatisfaction, existential angst. The suffering is enough to get all the hands up. Those are all words that the Pali word dukkha refers to, all these different ideas. And you've come to the right place because the Buddha said, I teach one thing, I teach only dukkha and the end of dukkha. So, everything I've mentioned, suffering, stress, dissatisfaction, discontent, existential angst, he claims he's teaching the end of this, which is really quite a profound, bold statement, really. It's really interesting to ask, well, what did he mean by that? And part of the answer has to do with what he means by dukkha. And it's something that's very subtle, something that we wouldn't consider suffering at all, actually. And my talk this evening actually was motivated by, as it often is, by my own personal dukkha, and that's what got me here in the first place, was deep dukkha. Someone that I love and care for very deeply became ill in late January, and after supporting this person for about a month, they were hospitalized and really didn't know what was going to happen, whether it would be okay or not. And, I was sitting around hospitals all night long, watching all this go on. And of course, then I got the flu because I was sitting around hospitals all night long and not getting any sleep. And really still don't know how this is all going to play out. And I shared my experience with a good Dharma friend, and I just really value Sangha. I encourage you really to get to know people in the Sangha so that you really can talk about difficulties, not in a complaining way, but from a perspective of Dharma, from the teaching, how do we work with this? And, she has a very strong practice and is going through some of her own personal difficulties with someone else who's suffering from cancer. And she wrote such a beautiful response that I have to talk about this. And I didn't really know where the talk would go. And I don't know where the talk would go this evening either. It's sort of the nature of things that, we're really not running the show. You kind of sit up here and hope that this mind-body complex will say something wise and useful. Ajahn Sucitto once said, well, if you talk enough, certainly one thing you say should be worthwhile. So I hope that, there's at least one thing that maybe you can take out of here that helps you on this path to really unconditional inner freedom. So I want to talk some about the framework for this practice. Before I read this response that I got from this person, to give us some context. And we're told here when we come that this is a mindfulness practice, or sometimes the beginning beginning class is called A Way of Awareness. And they're both translations of the Pali word sati. Pali is the textual language that the Buddha's teaching was written down in. It's not a spoken language. It was written down long after teachings actually took place. And sati is, like a lot of words, is very complex and depends upon its context. But one of the meanings is to remember, remembering. So it has to do with recollecting. So when we say we're practicing mindfulness, it's not so much attention, but it's remembering something. And, you know, what we remember depends upon the nature of our practice. So if we're trying to develop calm, and you have a particular object, like say the breath, then the role of mindfulness is to remember to keep coming back to the breath. It's keeping the check. And sometimes the translation awareness is used, which isn't just attention. It's kind of a monitoring function. You know, what's going on here, what needs to be brought in. So what are we supposed to be mindful of? Well, if we're doing samadhi, okay, it's the breath or whatever object you're working with. If we're, but the other way to look at it is this teaching of the Four Noble or Four Ennobling Truths. This was the first talk that the Buddha gave that set down the framework for all of his teaching. Everything that unfolded out of that came out as within that framework. And so, how many people are familiar with the Four Noble Truths? Okay. So not everybody, okay. So in a very simple way, the first noble truth is there is dukkha, okay, which usually is translated as suffering, and sometimes it really gets mistranslated in saying the Buddha said life is suffering. He didn't say that. He said there is dukkha, which is a really subtle term, and I'm going to come back and talk about that. And it's not personal. It's just everybody experiences some form of dukkha. The second noble truth is there's a cause for it. And the third is this really promising statement. There's cessation. It can be brought to an end. So this is dukkha and the end of dukkha. And then the fourth noble truth is this: there's this path, this way to cessation. And the path has to do with wisdom, which at first is a kind of a conceptual wisdom that we have some framework to work within. And the Buddha doesn't say, believe me. He says, ehi pasika, come see for yourself. So that really, this entire practice is about your own investigation. That it's not about having ideas about things, but about really having an embodied wisdom and understanding about what leads to inner peace. So there's a wisdom component, then there's ethics, which include kindness, compassion, non-harming, renunciation. And then there's samadhi, which is what most people think about as meditation, which is this sitting here and developing calm. And actually listened to a really beautiful talk by Joseph Goldstein. I just got back from retreat last Thursday. And he said all these teachings, everything the Buddha taught, all this about kindness, compassion, ethics, renunciation, has one purpose in mind, non-clinging. Cling to absolutely nothing as me or mine. That's the bottom line of this practice. So if you just stop doing that, you'll be free. Larry Rosenberg, when he practiced Ajahn Chah, said that it used to be that Ajahn Chah, whenever he saw Larry looking unhappy, he'd come up and he said, what are you attached to, Larry? What are you holding on to? Okay. So with that framework, I want to come back to the first noble truth, there is dukkha, and talk a little about what we mean by dukkha. And the Buddha talked about three forms of dukkha. And it's kind of nice to use the Pali terms just because the first form of dukkha is called dukkha-dukkha, or Narayan used to call it, double dukkha. And that's really what we probably think of mostly as suffering. But it has a full range. It could be sitting here, or some of you I notice, kind of having some pain in the knee or something and moving, or an itchy nose. Or it can be really serious things, old age, sickness, death, chronic illness, mental illness. I mean, these are really, you know, they're words, but these are really big things, and we all experience some form of it at some time. A good friend of mine said when the Buddha said there's dukkha, he really meant it. That there's just really great pain times. And so, you know, even when we get everything all lined up just the way we want, you know, maybe we're in the right relationship, we have a good job, our body feels good, things change. Joseph Goldstein said anything can happen anytime, you know, with the Boston Marathon and all the harm that was caused there. I mean, it happens every day. This is called the Parinama Dukkha. It's usually translated as the dukkha of impermanence. But it's also sometimes talked about as something that's contingent, that we really just don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, if we look at our own lives, it is the case that when we get things all lined up, they do change. There's nothing we can hold on to, which is why this non-clinging is such a strong aspect of the teaching. For those who have been in relationships, you know, we soon find that it's not eternal happiness. Well, there might be a year grace period or something, but... Ajahn Suchito once said that you can't guarantee happiness, but you can guarantee it won't last. So really, it's hard to envision how we could be free of these forms. I mean, things do change. There is contingency. We do get sick. We do lose loved ones. All these things happen. And, you know, we really can't stop that. We can live a more skillful life. We can be kind. We can be compassionate. We can take care of our body. We can have reasonable expectations and know that this is the nature of things. And there's tremendous value in that, just to be careful how we speak or how we act. The quality of compassion is just really uplifting. I was sort of facilitating the elders group many months ago, and someone said, why do we always talk about suffering? You know? And so, you know, I said, okay, we'll talk about, you know, kindness and compassion. And after that meeting, I went to the grocery store, and there was this elderly woman. She's all shriveled up, and she was reaching for some milk, and her hand was shaking like this. And she asked me to read the expiration date on the milk carton. And so I read it, and then I suggested there's some other milk that doesn't expire so quickly. And actually, even though her body is falling apart, she had these horrible teeth, she had a very sharp mind. And after that conversation, there's just such a sense of uplift in the body, such a joy. So, you know, this teaching of kindness and compassion is really valuable. It makes our life better. It's not going to eliminate all these problems of... that's in dukkha, dukkha, and viparinama dukkha, but it makes her life substantially better. And actually, someone who is a neuroscientist said that it actually takes about 8 seconds to take in positive experiences. So we seem to be kind of wired to focus on the problems. So it's really useful when you do an act of kindness, just something simple like opening a door from someone or an act of compassion, to really take in the feeling of it. It's a way to develop some wisdom about how to behave in this world that really leads to your own happiness as well as the happiness of others. So the third form of dukkha is called sankhara dukkha. And it's a very subtle term and hard to explain, but it's really important because the end of sankhara dukkha is the end of all forms of dukkha. It's really the core of all forms of dukkha, really. So sankhara is, it means something like to make or to construct, to fabricate. It's in an active sense. And it's also, in a passive sense, things that are made, constructed, and fabricated. Okay. And again, you know, exactly what it means depends upon the context. But within this dukkha, the sankhara dukkha, it really refers to the conditionality of the structure of self. That what we are is not something solid, but we are coming together of conditions. And we experience a sense of separation, someone outside the experience. And the end of dukkha is to see through that, to see through this sense of someone that everything's happening to. So maybe give you a little bit of a few examples on this. We experience a sense of space and a sense of there's moi sitting up here, that's the impression, and that there are these lumps of little lumps out in space out here, lovely lumps, but nevertheless lumps. And the way the nervous system works is, I mean, what's really happening here? Light waves come in to the eyes, and we've actually learned to perceive how to separate out objects. And there's an image projected in the back of the brain where there's no light whatsoever, that there are these objects out here that are maybe 7 feet away, 20 feet away, 30 feet away. And then the mind infers that there's someone watching these objects. It's a total mental construction. You know, you could actually be, all these images could be pasted on my glasses, because all there is visual consciousness occurring. And then the mind then constructs a reality around that. The reality is that there are these objects that are separate. And then the mind actually infers that there's someone watching it. It's a way the nervous system works. But what's happening really is you can't see the objects and have a sense of the subject at the same time. So the mind kind of sees this, then infers there's a me watching, and this sense of self gets created. Someone separate from the experience. Does that make sense at all? Maybe, okay. Another, and we also, the mind creates time. From memory, there's a notion of a past that existed, and then we project some sort of imaginary future. And both are really mental constructions. One thing that's really interesting about memory is that, first, it's not recorded accurately. We pull out certain things and say, oh, this is how things were. And second, memory changes over time. I mean, changes dramatically sometimes. So this imagined past we have is this fabricated construction. And clearly the projections in the future are just the same. So time is a construction. Space is a construction. I mean, that might seem like a big stretch for you. I want to go at some point about how we practice with this. But there's just now, and there's no one outside the experience. And the more that we can start letting go of this sense that it's all happening to me, the more freedom there is. You know, as I said, Joseph gave this talk, and he talked about all this stuff was about non-clinging. Well, don't cling to anything as me or mine. And if you think about it, is this body yours? Can you make it do what you want? Feel good all the time, stay young? I mean, one of the ways the Buddha teaches in the discourse on mindfulness is he goes through and says, okay, look at the body, see what it is. Go through all the body parts. You know, what are we really? Well, there's a liver, there's a heart, there's skeletal structure. If you break it down further, there's all the cells floating around. Some friend actually pointed out that we've had this kind of fascinating discussion that 90% of the cells we have in our body are non-human. They're mostly, what's the word I'm looking for, Bob? I can't think of it now. But you know, we're mostly non-human, really. They're not human cells. So he actually has people explore the body to start to get some inkling that this is not a solid, unchanging thing that's owned. And if you look at the mind, do you really own your mind? Well, why don't you just have, you know, pleasant emotions and pleasant thoughts? Can't really control it. I mean, what there is really is a kind of an intelligent process going on. And it can learn and it can see what leads to dukkha and what leads to inner peace. Okay. Now, so that's kind of the overview, and maybe we can talk about this more in the Q&A. So the second noble truth is the cause of dukkha is craving. There's a Pali word, tanha, which is usually translated as craving. And then the stronger form of it, it's kind of like maybe you see somebody has an ice cream sundae. I was out in the forest refuge, and I haven't had ice cream for years because I've been trying to keep my cholesterol level down, and they had ice cream sundaes, you know? And talk about craving. I mean, there's all these coverings, and, you know, so there's this craving, and now it gets stronger. There's clinging, you know, I got to... At first, it's like, oh, I got a little interest in it. Then I've got to have a sundae, and I sort of negotiate like, well, that's a really small amount, you know. And the whole sense of self gets created that way. I become the person who wants to have ice cream. There's actually a birth of a sense of identity that occurs out of craving. If you're feeling lonely, then, you know, you're a lonely person. If you're feeling happy, you're a happy person. If you're unhappy and you want to be happy, that's what you are. So we kind of get born and die moment after moment after moment. So there's craving for sense pleasures, just wanting to have a beautiful sunset to see, or... You know, if you wanted to have a really nice, crisp evening, you probably had some dukkha today, right? Because it wasn't that way. And that's the nature of craving. Isn't it always when we're suffering that the things are not the way we want them to be? There's something we want to get away from, or something we want to be different. And that's why this title that kind of came up, which came out of this friend's response and kind of joking around Maddie about bow to now. If we don't have some construction of a future that can be better, if we're not moving away from now, then there's no problem. It's the idea that we can have some alternative reality that creates the whole struggle. So that means somehow we have to find a way to open to what's ever there. So there's this craving for sense pleasures, and there's craving for a sense of identity. You know, I want to be an attractive person. I want to be a bright person. I want to accomplish a lot, loving, kind, you name it. Any idea that what we should be sets in motion some image in the future that you can become. And becoming actually is sort of, it's craving, clinging, becoming, birth. That's sort of this process that occurs. That's how the sense of identity gets created. And then, you know, what happens is then you get interested in something else, and there's a whole other process, and another you gets created. there's this sense because of memory that, you know, it's the same person this is all happening to, but it's really an illusion. Maybe stepping back a little bit about this little bit to the sankhara dukkha in relationship of that to craving is, what I said was that we infer there's a me hearing, a me seeing, okay, a me thinking. And one of the really most famous teachings was the Bahiya Sutta. And it's a story of the fastest awakening that ever took place in Buddhism. So listen carefully, this is your chance. And it's a really wonderful story about Bahiya, and I can't do that this evening. But basically, Bahiya really wanted to be awakened. And he comes to the Buddha and says, "You got to tell me." And the Buddha, kind of at first, he's really busy. But in Indian tradition, you ask three times, you have to answer. Finally, the Buddha says, "Okay, Bahiya, you should practice like this. In the heard, there's just the heard. In the seen, there's just the seen. In the felt, there's just the felt." And it goes on with each one of the senses. And from a Buddhist perspective, the mind's just another sense. So he says, in the known, there's just the known. A thought arises and it's known. And there's no one doing this. And what we call self is really just this moment-to-moment experience of the five sense experiences being known and the mind, thoughts shooting off, and emotions. That's all there is. No one owns it. And they're just kind of rolling on, changing really rapidly. But we get caught up in it. It's the craving that gets us caught. We don't like unpleasant experiences. And so we start pushing them away, imagining some future that I can have. Okay. So basically, when we can stop craving, stop clinging, we reach the third noble truth, cessation, inner peace. Now, when I first started practicing, I was at an Insight Meditation Society, and sometimes this word tanha gets translated as desire, which is problematic because desire has a wide range of meanings, and there's some desire that's really helpful, okay? So when we say you shouldn't have any desire, people say, well, you know. And when I was out at IMS, this teacher said, well, you know, you have to give up desires. Or he said something about, desire is the cause of dukkha. And I said, well, what do we do with all these desires? And he said, well, it's pretty hard to do anything if you don't have anything else. And somehow I didn't find that really a very helpful answer because I had no idea what anything else was. Really, because we see everything from the self-view, it seems only logical that, okay, everything's impermanent. I can't keep pleasant experiences all the time. I can't make this have all the great emotions all the time. But, my attitude was, well, I sure want as much of the good stuff as I can get. Okay? What we don't realize is that there's something else that we already have all that we need. And it's because of this sense of separation, the sense of this limited self that we construct, that we feel inadequate, that we need to fill ourselves up. That when we really see through this construction of self, then what we see is that we're really boundless, timeless. It's hard to explain what the experience is like because it's a total shift in consciousness. The best word that I think that we come across a lot of times in spiritual traditions is stillness. There's no sense of a subject, object, or knowing. of things. Which is kind of like the Bahia Sutta, if you think about it. There's just a herd. There's no one hearing. There's nothing. Okay, and so that's kind of the framework for this practice. And I'll try and talk a little bit more about cessation as I go through the talk. So that's the framework of the Three Noble Truths. And the Fourth Noble Truth, this Eightfold Path, is really a way to see this. And so there's a lot of cultivation of kindness and compassion and samadhi. So we have a good enough, I could say, sense of self, but really a skillful enough way to be in the world that we can sit back and see what's going on. It's really creating enough skill that you have this steadiness to see how craving creates a sense of separation, sense of self, and that when you drop the craving, there's freedom. Okay. I was with a friend last week, and she said, I think the Buddha blew it. He should have forgotten about this whole Eightfold Path and just said, don't cling to anything. And it is dangerous that people can get lost in all this other stuff, just developing deep concentration and stuff, and not realize that really the clinging is the problem. And you can cling to meditative states. I had a good sitting, I didn't have a good sitting. That's dukkha, right? Preference for one or the other. So this is a response to my friend. And I'll just say a little bit about the experience that I had. As I said, I got sick, I was in the hospital. I had for a while this sense of stillness. I mean, I just moved through this whole crisis with ease and connection. But then I got sick and, I just kind of tired and then I got lost. Okay. So my friend wrote this. Thank you, my friend, for sharing the inevitable and sad dukkha that comes into our lives. Different forms, characters, and situations, but nevertheless, pointing to the First Noble Truth. So the First Noble Truth, there is dukkha. And lots of times there's dukkha and we don't know it. So it's really good to kind of, okay, is there dukkha here? Just to kind of check it out. What are you clinging to? So that you see in dukkha, and then your next step is, okay, what am I clinging to? Okay, so when a loved one becomes ill, there is no place to rest. Stillness is there at times, and we notice and bow to stillness. Then the sadness, and when compassion comes, we bow to that. The ebb and flow of non-attachment and attachment, the Bodhi mind, which is the awakened mind, and the mind and heart of a man, father, husband. I know that dance well. Sadness exists or frustration or overwhelm or ouch of the situation. You, my friend, are dealing with a lot, including a human dislike of being powerless and grappling with the unknown. My heart holds you and your wife with much understanding, with love, and with the faith that you will navigate this difficult time with stillness and sadness, enlightened and human. So we don't get free of difficulty. We have sadness, we have compassion, we're in places where we're powerless. And our practice is to bow to all of that. To do otherwise is some form of craving, of pushing away, of creating a sense of someone outside the experience. So this was kind of interesting to me. I ended up talking to four different teachers about this, because when I first came to practice, most of the literature was in the Zen tradition, and D.T. Suzuki, who was kind of a scholar and Zen practitioner, was asked what being awakened was like. And he said, it's just like normal life, except you're about 2 inches above the ground. And I told that to one of my wife's brothers, who teaches Chan, which is Chinese Zen, at a university, and said, you're going to be disappointed. it isn't that we get free from difficult emotions. It's that we really learn to open to them. And in doing so, we become more human, more vulnerable, more connected. Now, the Mahabhua, who was supposedly an arahant, at least most people believe so, fully awakened person, cried once, and some people thought, he's not arahant because he cried. Or there's a very famous story of a Zen master whose son died, and they're at the funeral, and he's crying. And one of the monks says, well, it's all empty. He said, yes, but it's the saddest kind of emptiness. Ajahn Chah, who was one of Larry's teachers and many other teachers, senior teachers here, had diabetes the last 20 years of his life, and he's paralyzed. Last 10 years, I don't think he could speak. And at one point, a monk came up to him, and he said, oh, well, it's all empty. And Ajahn Chah said, it's harder than you think. Okay. So when I shared this reading and kind of query Narayan, who practices with Master Sheng Yen, who's basically a Chinese Zen teacher, she gave me his dying words. He said, busy with nothing, growing old, within emptiness, weeping, laughing. Intrinsically, there is no I. Life and death thus cast aside. So what happens is we really know there's no one that this is happening to. And in the opening to it, there's a sense of ease with it. Yeah, I had, quite some time ago, I went through a similar experience I went through this winter, and I remember my wife and I were lying in bed and just kind of shocked at what we had to deal with. Very serious financial situation, someone's health at stake, and just a lot of things. And some people protect themselves from emotions by going up in their head and thinking about things. It's a way to distract from feeling what's there. I found out that what I do is I stop breathing. Or at least I really lower the breath. So I don't go into the story, but the body doesn't feel so good if it doesn't get enough oxygen, okay? And then I was just lying there, and at some point I thought, oh, just come to the body. And then I started sobbing. And it's okay if you just let the emotion flow through. And when we don't let the emotion flow through, what we resist persists. So when we have fear, it's to really learn to open to the fear. If you have loneliness, open to the loneliness. Rather than focusing on the object you're lonely for, to really feel the experience, to examine it. And what can happen is dramatic shifts can take place. There's kind of a release that takes place on a bodily level. And for a lot of people, when they start to meditate, they find out they're really anxious, they're restless, difficult experiences come up, because for the first time, they're not running around keeping themselves busy. And then these feelings that are locked in the body come up. And we want to be able to open to them in a way that doesn't overwhelm us, but a way that allows a release. Shunryu Suzuki, or Suzuki Roshi, who was a wonderful teacher whose teachings are written in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, a book I've probably read about 10 times or more, said, fully burn every moment like a bonfire. So not to deny our experience, but really to open to it, to leave no trace, that's our path to freedom. And that can be really difficult. There's a story by Pema Chodron, who's a Tibetan teacher, who in the monastery, there's this woman who was really cold to her. just really icy. And it bothered her a lot. And so one night she swore that she was going to sit through this. And here's her description of her experience. She says, as I sat, I began to have this quality of experiencing what I was going through with this woman. I had a body memory of being a very little child, but it wasn't like I was remembering a traumatic experience or anything. I just realized at a cellular level that in my entire ego structure, my entire personality was designed never to go to this particular feeling. And so that's what happens. You know, in a very reasonable way, not in a judgmental sense, we learn to protect ourselves. And when we're young, we need to do that. But then it gets locked up in a whole personality structure, and it limits us. It's this sense of separation that gets created out of this resistance to what's there. So anyway, that my entire ego structure, my entire personality was designed never to go to this particular feeling. I began to experience a deep feeling of inadequacy, like I wasn't okay. And not feeling okay, not feeling adequate, is the most pervasive form of suffering I've come across in this practice. When I was teaching the elders group, a woman who was 81 years old said, you know, when I was 80, I was hoping my father would be off my shoulder. And it's true with young people as well, this sense of inadequacy. And, you know, I could do a whole talk about how that gets created, and we get all these social cues about how we should be, and we don't show all of ourselves, we suppress them. And that gets locked up in the body. And we strive to be the way we should be. We turn ourselves into an object. You know, there's a part of the mind that says, oh, you know, the judging part, you know, it says you should be like this, or you're too fat, you're too skinny, you're not very smart, or it says the opposite. It's still a problem. Because if you think yourself great, you got to stay great. I mean, I know some people are so accomplished, and they keep on pushing. Because that's the identity they've constructed, and they have to support it. And at some point, they won't be able to. Unless maybe they get hit by a car or something. But, you know, if you get old, the mind starts deteriorating, the body starts deteriorating, you can't hold up the image. So she said, I realized that what I was experiencing is the complete death of the ego. Now, I kind of doubt that it was complete death of the ego. But I do think that what can happen is we start chipping away at these things that limit us. We learn to open to them. Okay. So I want to maybe, just for people who are relatively new and even for people who are fairly experienced, just to give a little framework for this in terms of practice. There's a nice acronym called RAIN, which a group of teachers put together. And it stands for recognize, accept or allow, investigate, and not identify. Okay? Recognize, accept or allow, investigate, and not identify. And it's just a great way to kind of have a structure for practice. So recognize, notice there's some form of dukkha. And then to allow or accept isn't resignation. It's really just opening to what is, not knowing what's going to happen. Okay? And just seeing what might unfold, not out of the ego structure, but out of a quality of empathy. Just bringing this felt sense, this heart sense to the body and seeing what's needed. There's kind of an intelligence there that can figure things out. And we can't really understand things if we don't allow it, accept it. Because if we keep pushing it away, we never really get an understanding. So we're always trying to fix things. We're lonely. So we run around trying to get in a relationship. We don't really understand what the loneliness is about. I went through this where I went through it where I was having tremendous loneliness. Instead of trying to fix it, because I didn't really have a choice, I was with it. And I realized I'm perfectly happy alone. It was like this habitual experience. I'd go on retreats for 3 months and I don't speak to anyone, I don't read anything, perfectly happy. And when you get into relationship not out of need, but just out of a sense of joy, that's a relationship. That's a real connection. Okay. So then investigate, I only have a few minutes, so 5 minutes. But you know, it depends. When I was at the Forest Refuge this month, some bad news came, and there's this approach is called holistic awareness, Ajahn Suchito teaches, which I really like. Holistic awareness to him means that there's the bodily awareness, just to be aware of how the body feels. Notice are you breathing? You know, are you tightening up somewhere? Just kind of scan the body and relax that. You know, how's the heart feel? That's the second piece. So the body, heart, this felt sense, this kind of intuitive understanding, this quality of empathy we can bring to dukkha to see what's driving it. And then there's a conceptual piece, you know, really thought that plan organizes, projects stuff. So, you know, the Buddha in terms of thought said, well, he separated thought into two categories, thoughts that are afflictive and thoughts that lead to peace. And he just said, abandon thoughts that are afflictive. Okay, so what happened to me? Okay, I get bad news, and then the response is, what this is all going to mean? And then I think, okay, this isn't helpful. I don't know what's going to mean, and even if I do, it's just taking me out of the now. It's constructing a future. That's why it's so precious to be now. It's not a moment sandwiched between past and future. It's just this eternal presence, timeless. And so I came to the body, and then there's this heaviness there. Okay. And I sat with the heaviness, and there was aversion to the heaviness. I didn't want to feel that way. And then this voice came, and it said, what are you clinging to? And what I was clinging to is a mood. As my mood. So you can have moods and don't claim ownership to it. Ajahn Chah has a beautiful little piece he wrote about that moods come and trick the mind, that the mind is inherently peaceful. And this is what our difficult practice is about, is seeing through that. Not claiming moods as me or mine. Not claiming the body as me or mine. That there's a quality of mind that's at peace in the midst of whatever is going on. So sometimes it's useful to ask questions, you know, in the midst of discomfort. You can ask, where is the comfort in this? And the comfort is in deep acceptance, just allowing, okay, there's discomfort here. Don't struggle with it. You know, if we're down, where's the uplift in it? There's something that's at peace in the midst of all this that's going on, okay? So this is pretty high-level stuff. I'm going to end here, and for people who want to leave, feel free to, and maybe we can get some questions. It gets a little more down-to-earth. Okay, great. Thanks. Thank you very much. Okay, so just open up to anybody. Any questions about anything? Does have to be regarding the talk. So nobody in here has any dukkha at all?
I have some trouble.
Just to say,
I have some
close.
Trouble understanding the difference between accepting something as it is and wanting to make changes.
Yeah.
So when I think about what I want for myself and the world and making things better, I get confused between when is that clinging and striving, and when is that a natural, good for the universe activity that I engage in.
Yeah, it's. I think it's a question that maybe we all ask in some way. I think in part is to look at the energy of the movement and whether you're moving out of a sense of sensitivity and responsiveness to what's going on, or out of some idea about how you should be. I actually have taken this question up kind of intensely in the last year. I practiced with Joseph Goldstein last year, and he said, well, practice Wei Wu Wei. And Wei Wu Wei comes from the Taoist tradition. It means action without action. Well, what's that mean? Well, it means that things are done without any sense of someone doing it. And you know, for me, one of the big sticking points was sort of like I felt like I should be doing more. And that's not Wei Wu Wei. That's a sense of a me who's been taught some ideas, and I'm filling this role of meeting those ideas. So if you're moving naturally from a place of the heart, then that's a kind of a guide from it. If you're doing it because you think you should, that word should comes up, you know you're problematic. Eckhart Tolle has a nice little description of different forms of aspects of awakening. And so he talks about acceptance as one level, you know, things are just the way they are. A joy that we're really connected. And a third one is when there's just this enthusiasm to do something, there's a real love for it. And he talks about really having, being careful that once it gets stressful, you can know the sense of I came in. You know, there's attachment to the results rather than the process. And, you know, it's, you know, his teaching is very much about what's the most important. He talks about, you know, that what is the most important thing? It's what we're doing right now. And as soon as we start attaching to, put that aside for some end objective, that gets to be problematic.
But isn't that where many great things get created? You, in the, you know, now maybe you have a meeting that you're not necessarily looking forward to, and that leads to something wonderful coming.
Probably, yeah. I mean, it's a really tricky area. I mean, I asked Joseph because I got really interested in, well, okay, if I don't sort of say, want to do all these things to save humanity or something other than when it's my natural move of my heart. And I remember Joseph gave a talk about these, up in this mountain, there are these hermits who each have a cave and a garden, and they're committed to being there the rest of their lives. And from Joseph's perspective, those hermits contribute as much to society as a Mother Teresa. And if you know, I guess in some sense his explanation would be, if you look at the Buddha, he spent his whole life exploring his own inner freedom. And it was a tremendous gift, right? So I think you know, just really need to look carefully at what's driving it and the energy that's behind it. And sometimes you do push it, right? But what is the push coming from? Is it coming from a really sense of passion and love, or is it coming from a sense of duty. But it's a tricky area. Right? It's a good question. Yeah. Anybody else? Thanks.
Thank you. I'm finding that with the here and now and accepting the inevitable dukkha that happens in life, that you do shift from an intellectual kind of wanting to solve things, but then it gets into an area where the decision you have to make based on the here and now are difficult ones because it may require changes because certain people in your life are what they are. And it may be behavior and conduct that is not conducive to a healthy life.
Yeah.
So for me at least, it's like, okay, I'm okay with making this tough decision. And that's not out of hatred or anger. It's that it is what it is. I can't change these people. I could just relate to it in a different way. And I feel okay with that. But the people around you are like, wait a minute. You should be doing this and this. So they're doing the selfing of what I should do. And I'm saying, I don't want to be that, these things. I just want to deal with the here and now. But it's hard. But again, it's supposed to be hard, I guess, because life is dukkha. So anyway, that's just a comment.
Yeah. So it's really just kind of a statement, I guess, that it's hard to do this?
Well, no, I'm just saying that that's what I'm dealing with, and I feel okay with it. And
yeah.
I don't know. The practice, I think, has helped me, I think, you know.
Yeah. Let me maybe sort of address your question a little bit more, too, and yours as well. Is, I mean, what I'm talking about is pretty advanced, okay? It's like when you're really not a sense of identity there, when you really can totally open up, this is the experience. So that's where we're trying to get to. Okay, but we get caught, we get hooked. You know, we don't like unpleasant experiences. We do have views and opinions we're attached to. We get angry, right? And so, you know, in some sense, I think my experience and experience of people I think of kind of whose practice I really respect is that we kind of see through this sense of identity, through the sense of someone outside experience, but then you still get hooked. You still get fooled in. So sometimes in Zen, there's this discussion, you know, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. It's like, okay, you know this now, but you still have all these kind of programs that got developed over, you know, 20, 40, 50 years, 60 years. They don't just disappear. And so a lot of the Buddha's teaching is really kind of creating healthy programs. That's another translation of Sankara that Ajahn Suchito uses, is to create healthy programs and just let the other ones die out. So there's really a lot of practice is, you know, cultivating kindness, cultivating compassion, renunciation, living a simple life. And the Buddha is saying, do these things. And there really is a sense of effort in that. And sometimes he says, well, you know, bite your teeth or something, you know? I mean, you just don't want to act out of some unskillful way. So it's always tricky to talk about these two things because there's this kind of aspiration in this place where we can rest at times. And there's times when we get hooked and we really need to take some willful action because we can't really. Which reminds me, I didn't read the thing I wanted to read at the end, so for the people who are still here, if I can find it. Maybe I didn't read it because I can't find it. I don't know. Let's see. Oh, here it is, okay. So this is a description of stillness. It's really, this comes from the Udana. I was going to read this at the end and I forgot. For one who clings, motion exists. But for one who clings not, there is no motion. Where no motion is, there is stillness. Okay, so the stillness is the sense of no subject, no object. You know, there's no one outside the experience. Where there's stillness, there is no craving. Where no craving is, there is neither coming nor going. Now, coming or going is talking about this continual birth and death, the character, okay? Where there's neither coming nor going is, there is neither rising nor passing away. So there's no impermanence in this now. There's no time. Where there's neither rising nor passing away, there is neither this world nor that world nor a world in between. So this world refers to a subject. That world refers to object. And the world in between is consciousness, the knowing that occurs. And so he's saying when there's no clinging, or neither this world nor that world nor a state in between, this verily is the end of suffering. So this is just saying, when you don't cling to anything, there's no coming and going, no birth and death, moment to moment. There's no impermanence. The Buddha didn't say all things are impermanent. He said all conditioned things are impermanent. And that's the end of suffering. So this place of stillness is the end of it. Okay. So, but yeah, you have to do things. And because we're not fully awakened, that in times requires will. But ideally, we want to move out of a place of sensitivity and responsiveness rather than out of some idea about how we should be. Because as long as we do things in order to, we're creating a sense of identity. Even meditation, this whole subject-object orientation of meditation creates a sense of identity. And it was interesting, I was out with Joseph, he actually talked about just feeling our experience rather than watching our experience. That there's just a knowing without a knower. That's, and his, you know, he really talked about how his practice really shifted from that. And for a while, you really have to do with a sense of witness, but that's the kind of end game, is to really not have someone who's trying to be free. As long as you're trying to be free, you can't be free. It's sort of about not doing. Anyway, back down to earth. Yeah. Thanks.
Forgive me if I ask the same similar question, but I'm still a little, I wouldn't mind hearing you speak about it a little bit more on the should.
Yeah.
I mean, many of us, at least certainly I, grew up in a Judeo-Christian tradition with a whole sense of morality and right and wrong and a whole bunch of rules. And ever since I was a small child, you know, too small to make up my own mind, I was, you know, I grew up with the whole sense of what was of a moral structure, which leads me to sort of think about a lot of shoulds.
Yeah.
I should behave a certain way, I should act a certain way, I should work a certain way, I should live my life a certain way. Can you talk a little bit more about how I should think about those shoulds? Should I disregard them all, or?
You can get that out of Buddhism too, right? You should be kind, you should be compassionate, you should renunciate, you should behave all these ethics. I think the bottom line is there's no sense of separation, then you would act out of kindness and compassion. And you wouldn't want all of these things. You know, you wouldn't need to get all these objects, success, etc., if you really drop, if the sense of self was totally let go of. So these quote shoulds are ultimately a realization that, you know, you actually would naturally behave in a way that you would think is morally responsible. And so I kind of think of it like a good check. You know, if you're starting to do something harmful or something like that, you're really caught in the sense of identity of, in the Buddhist greatest greed, hatred, and delusion type sort of thing, that you're hooked. And then, you know, you really need to make an effort not to behave inappropriately. So it's not kind of like throwing it out the window, But it really is the end game is to, and I think this happens gradually. You start seeing that these behaviors that are motivated out of greed and hatred don't lead to your own personal happiness. And so you gradually change. And then it becomes more of an embodied action as opposed to some should. Okay. But it's really, you know, we are conditioned. We are so conditioned in this society, and probably all societies, but we're conditioned to be productive. I mean, Ajahn Sucitto has this great thing, practice aimless wandering. You know, even we meditate, we probably have to achieve something, right? But why? It takes us out of the now. I mean, could we actually just out of the flow? I mean, actually, when we move out of the flow, it's a really creative energy. It's not all this oomph and tightening. There's a lot more energy available than out of this driven kind of thing. So it's you know, it's an exploration. And I think, you know, the guidelines are there. When you look at them and you say, well, I don't want to do this. I want to be, you know, greedy or whatever. Then use that as an investigation. What is it that's driving that? Rather than just going ahead and doing it, where is the resistance coming from? Okay. And sometimes it's just habitual. You know, one year I took on, what's called right speech, which basically has four components to it. Is it kind? Is it true? Is it beneficial? And is it timely? Okay. And I basically made an effort to drop all negative speech, all complaining, endless discussions about politicians, all that sort of thing, because it really is negative energy to it. So there's like this guideline, here's right speech, here's a practice to take on. But when you actually take it on, it becomes freeing because you see aspects of yourself and you see those aspects aren't healthy. Does that help? Yeah. Okay, anyone else? Yeah, okay. It's been a delight.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.